All right, good evening. It is Thursday, the 12th of July, 2012, and I'm Peter Klein, and I'm glad to see all of you here with us for another session of Austrian Microeconomics. This is our second full session of the course, a third if you include the free preview session that we did. We're talking about the Austrian approach to valuation, exchange, demand, pricing, competition, and so forth, what are conventionally called microeconomic topics, to use modern jargon. We had a great discussion last week on the basics or preliminaries of human action, valuation, preference, the notion of human action as choosing one thing and setting another aside, the way Mises characterized it. And we talked a little bit how valuation might be reflected in our preferences for specific for units of goods and services. And you remember from last time, one of our key insights was that a human action is always about the valuation and choice among specific, discrete, marginal units of goods and services, rather than sort of, you know, some kind of good or service in general or broad categories of things. Economic action is not about what we want, like the little kitty cat here, when we want it, except to the extent that those are represented in actions about, you know, specific discrete things, things that actors have some control over, that they can conceive over, that they can partition in some sense and, you know, offer in exchange. And that's what we want to look at today in a little bit more detail, is how the valuations of individual actors in the market, their subjective preferences, their utilities, as it were, how those are reflected in their behavior in markets. So, let's start, whoops, wrong button, I always do that. Let's start by kind of reminding ourselves of sort of a general way of classifying or a typology, if you like, of human action. Well, human action can be, we can distinguish between autistic or one person action and, you know, interpersonal multi-person action, right? So, you know, Robinson Crusoe on his desert island, or, you know, you sitting in your home and not interacting with anybody else, you know, you're still engaged, of course, in goal-oriented behavior. You're still engaging in purposeful human action. If you like, you can think of even autistic behavior as a kind of exchange, in the sense that the actor is hoping to exchange, you know, a more satisfactory state of affairs for a less satisfactory state of affairs, right? You, you know, reach down to take a drink of water because you prefer the state of affairs in which your thirst is satisfied than the state of affairs in which, you know, you're thirsty. But of course, we're primarily interested when we talk about exchanging, in exchanges among people, right? Interactions among multiple human beings. So interpersonal action can also be broken down into different categories, right? There's interpersonal exchange, and two categories of interpersonal exchange. I distracted myself for a moment by looking into the chat window. Danny or Jacob, could you post the link to the slides for those who want to print out the PowerPoint files so they can take notes on them or whatever as we go? Anyway, sorry, I was saying interpersonal exchange can be voluntary or coercive. Now, in economics, we mostly talk about voluntary exchange, right? But you can imagine exchange being coerced as well, right? By voluntary exchange, we mean, you know, giving a gift, right? And also, you know, what we normally think of as voluntary exchange. I give you something in exchange for something that you give to me, right? And notice that that exchange can be, you know, it could be with prices and money, but it also could be barter. It could involve services as well as gifts. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It could involve cash or whatever. Of course, one of the key insights we have from voluntary exchange is the idea that voluntary exchange is mutually beneficial, right? Both parties to an exchange are better off, at least in an ex ante sense. And we know this because If that were not the case, they would not have participated in the exchange in the first place. Okay? Even gift giving involves mutual benefit, because the giver presumably gets some benefit just as does the recipient. Otherwise, the giver wouldn't have given the gift. Exchanges, interpersonal interactions more generally can of course be coercive as well. You know, what in legal theory we call a tort, you know, beating somebody over the head, assault, theft, robbery, murder, and so forth. Those are kinds of interpersonal exchanges, right? But they certainly aren't voluntary on the part of the victim. And by no means can we say that both parties to such an exchange are made better off, okay? But you can also think of, you know, milder cases, what we might call coerced exchange. You know, you might think of slavery as a kind of coerced exchange. I mean, it is an exchange, right? Because in the typical case, you know, it isn't that the slave gets nothing, right? The slave gets some kind of food and clothing and shelter and maybe some sort of medical care, right? So there is an exchange. The slave provides the services, labor services, in exchange for minimal food, clothing, and shelter, in exchange for not being beaten, in exchange for not being shot, and so forth. But we certainly wouldn't think the slave is made better off as a result of that arrangement. Any sorts of transfers of income between the government and the taxpayer, right? When you pay a tax, you give that money to the government, you do get something in return, at least some people do, right? They get government services. I pay my taxes, my federal income taxes here in the U.S., in exchange for which I get the privilege of being groped by the TSA whenever I fly. But I wouldn't call that a voluntary exchange. I prefer not to pay that tax and not to have the TSA whatsoever. You're getting conscripted into the army and being paid a wage or a salary that you don't want. Where you'd rather not be in the army whatsoever would be an example as well. And of course, those of you in the U.S. who have been following the debate over the so-called Affordable Care Act, or what is commonly called Obamacare, right, recognize that the key issue that was just decided by the U.S. Supreme Court 2 weeks ago is whether the federal government can compel people to purchase insurance from a select group of private providers. So that's a very literal, direct, coerced exchange. I mean, the Affordable Care Act, if implemented, says that everybody has to buy health insurance. That's an exchange, right? You pay money, you pay a premium to the health insurance company in exchange for which it provides you insurance services, and you have some ability to choose among providers that are on an approved list, but you can't choose not to make that transaction whatsoever. So it certainly isn't voluntary, except in a very trivial sense of choosing among approved providers. So we're all in the U.S. Everybody's been talking about coerced exchange, right? And there are a lot of convoluted arguments that proponents of this particular legislation will trot out to explain how having everyone covered by insurance makes society as a whole better off. And there's some arguments they try to make about how even the individuals insured are really better off being coerced into making this exchange. But that's a very difficult case to make, right? Because, of course, if the uninsured, otherwise uninsured person believed that purchasing insurance from one of these providers would make him better off, he would have already done it. Right, the fact that he hasn't done it indicates that this consumer believes him or herself to be better off without this buying this good or service. So you get people in sort of behavioral economics saying, "Oh, well, people are deceived, or they're irrational. They don't really know. We, the behavioral economists, we know what will make this person better off." But the poor individual doesn't know. Or the government knows what exchanges will make you better off, but you don't know. Of course, this violates the concept that we discussed last time, right? That we're only interested, the only preferences that are sort of praxeologically relevant are those that are in fact demonstrated in action. So it's simply impossible from a praxeological point of view to say that Mr. X would have been better off if he had bought this thing, which he didn't buy, unless he actually buys it. Okay? Otherwise, it's just pure speculation that, well, in some sense, he really would have been better off if he had done it. I mean, maybe ex post, he would have decided he was better off if he made the exchange. But we simply don't have that knowledge. Right? We have no way as scientists to know what are Mr. X's true preferences other than the preferences he demonstrates through his voluntary choices in the market. Let me just elaborate on that in for just a moment. It sort of goes without saying that we're making some assumptions in our treatment of voluntary exchange, right? We're assuming at least two preconditions. The obvious one being reverse valuation. Right, each party prefers the thing that he acquires over the thing that he gives up, and those preferences have to be in reverse order. So, here in my little picture, you've got a French or English trader. I can't really see what's going on. He's trading gold coins in exchange for beaver pelts. Right, for this exchange to take place and not be coerced, it must be the case that the Native American Indian prefers the gold coins to the specific gold coins that are being considered for exchange over the beaver pelts that he gives up, and the French or English trader values the beaver pelts more highly than the coins that will be given up. This is sort of obvious point. And of course, you have to have knowledge of your trading partner to be able to say that voluntary exchange is, that exchange is truly voluntary, and that to be able to make these statements about well-being, right? So, I mean, yeah, there might have been another guy who's not in the picture who might have offered one of these parties even better terms, but the fact that that party was unknown in no way implies that the exchange that was made wasn't voluntary or that there weren't mutual gains to be had from it, okay? So, that's the sort of simple but really powerful point about well-being or utility or welfare, right? And this idea that that voluntary exchange is mutually beneficial. There is a mutual gain in well-being in an ex ante sense from all parties who participate in voluntary exchange. By the way, that is such a powerful insight. And most of you who are in this class, you're interested in economics, you're enthusiastic about economics, you've probably taken other economics courses before, you find this a kind of trivial insight. But, oh my gosh, to the general public, to policymakers, to lots of writers and thinkers and scholars throughout history, this is an absolutely shocking, breathtaking, revolutionary insight. Most people don't get it. Right, the common view of exchange that's held by people who haven't thought much about economics is that in a voluntary exchange, one party gets the better of the other. Right, trade, market behavior is about screwing the other guy, so he doesn't screw me. There is maybe a sense that there's sort of a casual sense that we sometimes feel that way. Right, you go and you buy a car, and you're bargaining with the car dealer, and you agree to purchase a brand new Honda Civic for $18,000, and you sign the contract, you hand it over the money, you drove away with your Honda Civic, and some people get home and they say, "Man, that dealer really pulled a fast one on me. Oh, that dealer, I can't believe he did that to me. Oh, I'm so mad." Now, what people mean when they say that, of course, is, well, I acquired a Honda Civic in exchange for $18,000, so I actually prefer the Honda Civic to the $18,000. But I wish I could have gotten it for $15,000, right? I can imagine, I can conceive of an exchange that I would have preferred even more than the exchange that I just engaged in. Yeah. Which I mean, fine, we can say that, but who cares, right? That isn't relevant in any way to determining action, as long as you were willing to part with the car for $18,000, sorry, to part with the $18,000 to get the car, the fact that you would have rather had the car for $16,000 or $10,000 or for free, right, in no way means that you aren't better off trading $18,000 for the car. If people get very confused on this point and think, oh, well, gosh, you know, the fact that the dealer could extract $18,000 from you proves that the dealer, you know, got you. The dealer was made better off, but you were harmed somehow. But of course, just thinking about that logically indicates the absurdity of it. Right? If you were harmed, you wouldn't have bought the car. Right now, of course, we're not talking about fraud. You know, you get home and the car isn't as advertised, it isn't what you contracted for, or that you have a change in your preferences. And, you know, you experience some ex post regret. You're cruising down the street in your brand new Honda Civic, and, you know, here in the other direction comes a Toyota Corolla, and there's a natural human impulse, right, to say, ooh, gosh, I wonder if I would have liked the Corolla better. Fine, that isn't relevant, right? We can still say from a purely logical point of view that the fact that you participated in this transaction gives us information that your well-being in an extremely meaningful sense is higher than it was before you made the transaction, okay? You know, some obvious applications. This doesn't just occur, it doesn't just apply to, you know, trade among two individuals. It can apply to trade, you know, two individuals right next to each other. It applies to individuals trading across great distances, and, you know, the fact that the Frenchman over here is French and the Native American is, you know, an Iroquois or whatever, it doesn't have anything to do with the logical principle, right? So whenever people talk about, you know, trade between the U.S. and Japan, and, oh, isn't it terrible that the U.S. is you know, buying more from Japan, or China, that you know, the U.S. has a huge trade deficit with China. We buy more things from China than China buys from us. I mean, that's just silly, right? That's a pure statistical artifact because, you know, the U.S. and China are not actors. Those are aggregates of individuals. When we say that, you know, we say the U.S. has a trade deficit with China, we mean that the, you know, total money value of goods and services that individual Americans have purchased from individual Chinese or American firms from Chinese firms is greater than the amount that individual Chinese and Chinese firms have purchased from individual Americans and American firms. But assuming that all of those were voluntary transactions, we know that they were all welfare enhancing from the point of view of those parties that participated in the exchange. So it's just sort of meaningless to say that the U.S. is somehow worse off because the total volume of trade with another country, you know, has certain characteristics. It just doesn't make any sense. You know, another obvious implication is that, just as we discussed on the previous slide, right, I mean, restrictions on exchange cannot make trading parties better off. Right? You know, a law that says, you know, Iroquois can only give up 3 beaver pelts a day to French explorers, and no more than that. I mean, right, at best, that law doesn't have any effect. You know, it's not binding because the Indians only wanted to give up 2 pelts rather than 3. But if it is binding, meaning that at least one trader would have preferred to exchange 4 pelts for money rather than 3, well, then that restriction has eliminated or made infeasible a voluntary exchange that would have made both parties better off. Right? So restrictions on exchange cannot increase well-being. Right? Trade restrictions are always, strictly speaking, welfare-reducing. Okay? I mean, you know, you can't have a simpler case for free trade than that. And, of course, by free trade, I don't just mean trade across national boundaries, but free trade within national boundaries as well. You know, a quick note about you know, this idea of only looking at preferences that are demonstrated in action. Right? I noted that you know, again, you might have ex post regret, but you can't demonstrate ex post regret in action, so we don't know for sure if that is really, you know, if that is really present, and so it's just speculation. Likewise, the fact that you know, there's another French trader who's outside the picture who might have offered even better terms to this particular Indian, that also isn't relevant in assessing whether the two individuals in the picture are better off or worse off. You know, you often hear, you know, what we know to be true from a strictly logical or praxeological point of view is not the same as what we sometimes feel in our hearts to be true. Right? I mean, you know, in sort of casual discussion, we you know, people say things all the time like, oh, what would be a good example? You know, my Professor Salerno was hired to be the academic vice president for the Mises Institute. Man, I wanted that job, right? I applied for it. I mean, I didn't, but suppose that I had applied for the same job. Salerno and I both applied for this job, and Salerno and Bob Murphy and me all applied for the same job, and Salerno got it. Salerno got the offer and accepted. Bob Murphy and me, we didn't, you know, we were not offered the job. So Murphy and I are really angry, and we're ticked off, and we hate Salerno, and we're annoyed, you know, we're angry at the Mises Institute and so on. I mean, look, if you've ever applied for a job and didn't get it, right, or if you've ever, you know, you've ever tried to bid for something on eBay and you didn't win the auction, I mean, of course, I feel your pain. You know what it means to feel that kind of frustration, that you weren't able to make a trade that you wish you could have made. But the point is, you know, Salerno got the offer, and he accepted. So we know that Salerno, we know from that, right, that Salerno is better off with the job than without it, and that the Mises Institute is better off with Salerno and, you know, less the money they pay him rather than without Salerno. But if I never was actually offered the job, then I really can't, I have no opportunity to demonstrate that I preferred having the job at the salary offered to turning down the job. Right? I mean, that exchange was sort of never on the table. So I can say all I want, oh, if they had offered it to me, I would have taken it, and boy, am I angry that they didn't offer it to me. But, you know, that's just speculation, right? That's just idle chat. That's barroom conversation. It isn't real in the sense, well, we as economists, we don't have knowledge of those facts and those, you know, preferences in the same way that we have knowledge of Salerno's preferences and the Mises Institute's preferences. Right? We know in a scientific way, with great certainty, what is revealed in action. What's not revealed in action we can speculate about, but our knowledge simply doesn't have the same scientific character as the knowledge of what we observe demonstrated in action. Okay? And finally, you know, this is so, it's so straightforward, it's so obvious. To many people, this is a seemingly trivial point, this notion of, you know, thinking about the gains from trade in this way. But it's really powerful in coming up with a theory of, you know, so-called welfare economics more generally. There's a whole subfield within kind of mainstream economics on well-being and welfare, so-called social welfare, and so on. There's a lot of different important theories that have been offered. You know, Vilfredo Pareto, who was a follower of Val Ross, a co-discoverer of the marginal utility principle, along with Menger, although in a slightly different form. You know, many of you have heard of so-called Pareto efficiency or Pareto optimality, another kind of a criterion that people try to apply to distinguish among overall well-being, you know, in different kinds of sets of circumstances. You know, there's an old idea of from the 1950s of constructing a so-called social welfare function that can actually measure, you know, the aggregate well-being within a group of individuals or a society or whatever. Most of that's been pretty widely debunked. But of course, there's a lot of attempts to come up with reasonable proxies for overall well-being. You know, Mises and Rothbard basically rejected all of those kinds of attempts to come up with a measure of overall social utility or well-being. I think Rothbard put it very nicely when he said, look, all the free market is, all a market society, a voluntary market society is a whole lattice work of voluntary exchanges. Right, the market is this aggregate of voluntary exchanges. It's the whole collection of uncoerced voluntary exchanges that go on, you know, among individuals. And if each one of these is mutually beneficial, then we can say that the nexus of these relationships or the overall pattern of these relationships is also well-being, you know, in the only way that we can say it and make sense of it. Right, so the only way to characterize overall social well-being is in terms of this, you know, the sets of voluntary exchanges that go on among individuals. So, you know, this is in essence the why Austrian economists tend to think that the free market is a more desirable institutional arrangement than socialism or fascism or social democracy or whatever. But it doesn't take a very complicated set of arguments on welfare economics to explain that if one voluntary exchange is mutually beneficial, then lots and lots of voluntary exchanges, a whole society based on the principle of voluntary exchange, is going to sort of, you know, maximize welfare to the extent that that terminology even makes any sense. There's a great article by an author named Gary Lawson, published in the Duke Law Journal in 1992. It doesn't get as much attention as I think it should, called Efficiency and Individualism. And it's written kind of from the point of view of a law professor, and it's aimed specifically at concepts of well-being or welfare or efficiency that occur in the law and economics literature. But it really applies to contemporary economics more generally. And Lawson sort of goes through systematically, one by one, different concepts of social efficiency or social welfare that occur in, that have been proposed by various economists, and sort of dismantles them one by one and shows that they're all flawed, either theoretically or they have no operational content, like so-called Pareto optimality. And, you know, he sort of concludes that really all we can say is that voluntary exchange is better than coerced exchange. We really can't do much more than that. I think it's a very nice overview of different concepts of welfare in economics, and some why this very simple version of Austrian welfare economics is the best one. Okay, let's go through this in a little bit more detail. You know, what explains the limits to exchange? In other words, you know, why do people only exchange a certain amount and not more? Why aren't we just sort of constantly swapping things all the time? Why do we have definite finite limits in how much we want to exchange? Well, let me illustrate with a simple example that I shamelessly borrowed from Professor Salerno because I was too lazy to come up with my own example. Imagine two traders, A and B, with the potential to exchange cows and horses. Right, and assume that they're engaged in sequential barter, by which I mean, one party. A offers to trade one of his cows for one of B's horses, and they decide if they want to do that or not. And if they do, then there's an opportunity, to trade a second cow for a second horse, and so forth. Let's make some assumptions about the value scales, or the preferences, or the marginal utilities of these two different parties, A and B. Right, so assume that the value scales take the following form. Right, so A, you know, places the highest value on his first cow, and then of course he values his second cow less than his first cow. Why? Because of the law of diminishing marginal utility that we talked about last week, right? Second cow is not as valuable as the first cow. But let's assume that he values his second cow more highly than a first horse. First horse, obviously, more highly than a second horse. And assume that he values the second horse more highly than the third cow, and so forth. Okay, so I put cows in red and horses in blue to help us to remember which is which. And let's assume that trader B has a different set of preferences, right? His are also given here on the slide. Assuming that A has four cows, starts out with four cows and no horses. B starts out with four horses and no cows. And their value scales are as depicted in the diagram. You know, what kinds of exchanges are likely to take place? You know, what's the kind of final amount of trading? How much trading is going to take place? How many swaps of a cow for a horse will take place? Well, there are, you know, a few different ways that we can think about this. And of course, if you just sort of stare at it and ponder it logically, you're going to come up with the right answer anyway. But here's one convenient way to think about it. You know, imagine the first potential exchange of a cow for a horse. Well, let's look at A's value scales, right? A starts out with four cows, right? You know, but notice that the valuation of his fourth cow is quite a bit lower than the valuation of a first horse, right? So he would gladly give up his last cow, his fourth cow, in exchange for just one horse, right? And notice that I'm comparing the marginal utility of the first horse that he would acquire against the marginal utility of his last cow, because if he's going to give up a cow, he's going to give up the cow that is the least valuable to him, which would be his fourth cow. Right? He's not going to give up his first cow or his second cow or his third cow. He gives up the fourth cow. He still has three left. Right? So notice that Mr. A values a first horse over a fourth cow. What about Mr. B? Well, I mean, notice that Mr. B would gladly give up one horse to get one cow, right? Because the horse that he would give up, his fourth horse, is worth quite a bit less on his, is quite a bit lower on his value scale than the first cow that he would get from trade. Right, so A would, given the starting point, A would gladly give up one cow in exchange for a horse, and B would gladly give up one horse in exchange for a cow. So we have the opportunity for one mutually beneficial swap. Okay, both parties would be made better off by doing one swap of a horse for a cow. Okay, what about another one? Well, what about, would Mr. A be interested in, with these preferences, would he now be interested in acquiring another horse? Well, notice that another horse, his second horse, would rank higher on his value scale than his next available cow, his third cow, right? So he'd be interested in one more swap. What about Mr. B, right? Well, the next cow that he would acquire, his second cow, is more valuable, it's higher on his value scale than the next horse he would have to give up, his third house, that third horse. So there's an opportunity for yet another mutually beneficial swap of cow or horse. But now what do we do? Well, look at trader B, right? There's yet another swap that B would be interested in, right? Given his preferences, he would actually give up his next remaining horse for one more cow. Right? He values a third cow over a second horse, so he'd be interested in one more swap. But that isn't the case for trader A. Right? There's no, now that trader A has his two horses, he has two horses and two cows, he's not interested in obtaining a third horse. Because to obtain a third horse, right, he'd have to give up his third cow. And then he'd be giving up something that's more valuable in exchange for something that's less valuable. So that trade is not feasible, okay? So first swap is agreeable to both parties, given their valuations. Second swap is agreeable to both parties, given their valuations. But there is no third swap that satisfies the requirements that both parties would be made better off from engaging in that swap. So it doesn't happen, right? So if you want to use this terminology, the equilibrium allocation, right, is party, they trade two cows for two horses, and party A ends up with two cows and two horses, and party B ends up with two cows and two horses, okay? So that's the equilibrium result of this, hypothetical interaction. Notice, by the way, that, we're talking here about ranking cows and horses as individual units, right? We're trading one horse against one cow, kind of one feasible transaction at a time. We're not ranking or exchanging bundles, right? So some people get confused by this kind of example because they say, well, you know, what if B makes a take it or leave it offer and says, how about give me three cows for three horses, or I walk away and don't want to have anything to do with you. You know, take it or leave it. So now A is thinking about, well, does he prefer the bundle that he has now, four cows and zero horses, to the bundle of one cow and four horses? Right? I mean, to be able to answer that question, we need to have rankings of bundles. Right? We need to imagine all of the feasible bundles and then give each person, each actor, a preference ordering over those bundles, which we don't actually have in this example. We need more information, right, to be able to discuss these sort of take it or leave it offers in terms of bundles of cows and horses. Right? But if our value scales are expressed in terms of valuing marginal cows and marginal horses, right, then the equilibrium allocation is two trades where A ends up with two cows and two horses, B ends up with two cows and two horses, because we're only exchanging cows and horses, right, not exchanging bundles. So I just used the term equilibrium, which, you know, some of, you know, I just sort of slid it in there. Some of you may have been shocked. Right, if we're used to thinking that Austrian, you know, the characteristic of Austrian economics over neoclassical economics is that it rejects equilibrium, and yet there I sort of slipped it in. No, it's not the case at all that Austrian economists reject the notion of equilibrium per se. What they reject is specific equilibrium constructs, you know, like perfectly competitive Walrasian general equilibrium, which we'll talk about later, right, that have been developed within mainstream neoclassical economics. But, you know, the notion of equilibrium that we just described makes perfect sense. Right? In fact, there's a specific term for this kind of equilibrium in the Austrian literature. Mises used the term plain state of rest. Okay, so Mises' generic term for equilibrium is state of rest. Von Bavert used a German term that is translated as momentary equilibrium. Right, so the plain state of rest, as opposed to a fancier kind of state of rest, or this momentary equilibrium, as opposed to some kind of more elaborate, longer-term kind of equilibrium, right, simply refers to that point where the gains from trade have been exhausted, other things equal. Right, so within a particular trading situation where there are certain stocks of goods available for exchange, both parties have given preference orderings that we hold constant for the duration of trade. They know of each other's existence, right? And there's at least some, there's enough reverse valuation to have some potential gains from trade, right? As soon as trading stops, as soon as all gains from trade have been exhausted, then we are in what Mises calls, those two traders are in what Mises calls the plain state of rest. Okay? It's not very fancy. It's not fancy at all, right? But it's very important. Notice that this plain state of rest, you know, this is not some sort of arbitrary abstract concept that only applies to weird hypotheticals, you know, relating to cows and horses. No, this is what happens in the real world every time people buy and sell, okay? For example, you know, if I want to buy water, here's, I've got my little trusty water bottle here that I always have for these sessions. Because my throat gets dry when I get so excited about talking about taxiology. You know, the vending machine in my building sells these for $1.25. This was kind of crazy, but that's the price they charge. Suppose this is the third bottle that I bought today, right? Or if you want to think of, you know, you go into a convenience store and grocery store, and water bottles are $1.25 each, and you walk out, in, you know, with three of them in your shopping basket. if it's the case that I bought three water bottles. I didn't stop at one. I didn't stop at two, but I bought the third, and I didn't buy the fourth. Right? It must be the case that my value scale is like the one that you see in the slide, right? But we know from the law of diminishing marginal utility that my second water bottle is less valuable to me than my first, and my third water bottle is less valuable to me than my second, and so forth. Right? But the fact that I bought three indicates that I value all three of them over the $1.25 that I paid. Right? So even the least most valuable water bottle that I possess, right, is ranked at least one penny higher than $1.25, the posted price, right, the price that I had to pay to get it. And you know, $1.25 is worth more to me than a fourth water bottle, which I could have bought but didn't. Right? And this is true of anybody who purchases at a given price. Right? So assuming that posted prices don't change during the trading day or the market day, which is just an abbreviation for, you know, that period of time for which trade is feasible for this agent, right? Everyone who buys does so as long as the marginal utility of the last unit purchased exceeds the marginal utility of the money that you would, that you had to give up, the marginal utility of the price. So he said, note that marginal utility applies to money. Okay, I mean, in fact, I've got $1.25 in my preference ordering, just like I have units of water bottles. Okay, so money is an economic good, and quantities of money, prices, appear in an individual's value scale the same way that different goods or services appear in the value scale. Right? So in this example, with this setup, I buy three water bottles but not four. And having purchased my third water bottle, I have achieved the plain state of rest. The seller and I are both in a plain state of rest, meaning that that's the equilibrium amount of water for me to buy. Okay, I don't want to buy any more. I don't want to buy any less. And notice, by the way, this is true for the seller, too. Right, so that at the end of the market day or the trading period, as it, you know, is relevant in this example, you know, all the units that the seller didn't sell, right, are ranked higher on the seller's value scale than the units that were sold. Okay. Excuse me. I want to say it this way: all units that remain in inventory, right, are ranked higher on the seller's value scale than the money price, the $1.25. Right? How do we know that? Because the seller could have offered them at an even lower price. Right? The seller started out the day with a certain amount of water bottles, and there was an agreed upon price of $1.25, and at that price, the seller, you know, gave away every bottle that the seller ranked higher than $1.25 and held on to those that were ranked above $1.25. Okay? This is important because, you know, one of the things that we'll talk about in more detail next week is that, you know, in kind of the neoclassical treatment of exchange following Marshall, right, there's sort of a complete asymmetry between buyers and sellers. So demand is, you know, represented as, you know, coming from the subjective valuations of individual demanders, and you know, there are some differences between how Marshallians would construct a demand curve and how Austrians would construct a demand curve, which we'll do in just a minute here. But you know, they're in general agreement that subjective preferences of, you know, consumers determine the character of demand, the demand schedule, the demand price, demand curve. But they say on the selling side it's completely different. Right, that the preferences of the behavior of sellers, the willingness of sellers to exchange quantities of goods and services in exchange for particular prices, is totally determined by quote unquote objective factors, you know, resource characteristics and the profit maximizing behavior of the seller and so on. But there's two completely different processes. And those of you who have taken a mainstream introductory or intermediate microeconomics course know that you get, you know, one whole section on the theory of demand, and then you get a totally different section on theory of production or theory of supply. There's sort of no interaction between them whatsoever until you get to where the supply and demand curves intersect, right? In the Austrian view, the supply side of the market is determined by the same kinds of factors that determine the demand side of the market, right? Sellers also have preferences over units of good that are units of a good that they have in stock, and exchange values, prices of those units. We'll see when we, not this week, but next week, what Philip Bookstein called the total demand curve. We'll show how you can actually put the market demand curve and the market supply curve. You can represent them with a single curve in an exchange economy. So I just want to plant that little seed in your mind for now and promise you that we'll come back to it later. So, you know, for everyone who bought a water bottle, the last unit they bought ranks higher on their value scale than the price, $1.25. For the seller, right, all units that were let go are ranked less than $1.25. All units that are retained in inventory rank higher on the value scale than $1.25. And for people who could have bought but didn't, right, if you didn't buy any, that means that even the first water bottle to you would rank below $1.25 on your particular value scale. Okay, so that gives us sort of a nice way of characterizing the plain state of rest or this momentary equilibrium. Right? All possessors value the marginal unit above its price, and all non-possessors value the marginal unit below its price. Right? So by all possessors, we mean both buyers and sellers. Everybody who walked out of the store with some water bottles is a possessor, whether he's a buyer who bought them and gave up money, or a seller who decided not to sell, to reserve some units in inventory for another day. Right? Now, of course, the claim is not that there are no differences among types of possessors. Right? Now, the seller might also be a consumer, right? The seller might want to drink the water, but the seller might be refusing to give up some of the bottles at $1.25 because he thinks that tomorrow he can sell them for $1.50, right? Some of that is reservation demand on the part of the seller, desire to maintain inventories at a particular level, and so on. So what underlies the valuation may be different between buyer and seller, but it's still the case that in equilibrium, everyone who has a water bottle values his lowest ranked water bottle above $1.25. And everybody for whom that is not the case doesn't have any water bottles whatsoever. Okay, this is important, and we're going to come back to this point even later next week. Okay, now the plain state of rest or momentary equilibrium, you know, that's not the only equilibrium construct. That's the only one we're going to go into any detail on today. But there are lots of equilibrium constructs in Austrian economics. Now, about this, the plain state of rest, or PSR, I want to remind you, you know, about our causal realistic approach. Right? The PSR is not a hypothetical construct that exists only in our minds. That's not a good way to say it. I mean, the plain state of rest, that's a label that we use, but that does occur every day in the real world. I mean, every time you walk out of Walmart with, you know, one loaf of bread and not two, you're in a plain state of rest, right? Because for everything you purchased, the marginal unit ranked higher than the price, and for everything you didn't purchase at all, even one unit of that ranked lower for you on your value scale than the price. So the PSR, you know, this takes place every day, right, as the result of individual valuations on the part of buyers and sellers. Now, the reason this, you know, von Bobert called it a momentary equilibrium is because it doesn't last forever, right? You know, it lasts the duration of the trading period or the market day in the examples that we just gave. Right, a stricter way to define that is that the PSR lasts only until somebody's valuation changes, right, for a variety of reasons, right. So that when somebody's value scales change, well then, you know, then he will want to behave differently than he did when his value scale was something else. Okay. Other equilibrium constructs that we'll talk about to a greater or lesser degree during this course are what Mises called the final state of rest, which is a kind of long-run equilibrium construct in which we, you know, we hold everything equal for some period of time, and we allow a sequence of trades, and we allow people to learn from their mistakes, and people to revise their expectations, and so forth, and eventually you get to a point where nobody wants to change his behavior at all. You know, this is, it's not exactly the same, but it's closer to, you know, kind of sort of standard notion of Marshallian equilibrium that you get in the neoclassical text. There's also an intermediate construct that doesn't really have a good name. Mises didn't name it, but Salerno and I refer to it as the Wickstedian state of rest in honor of Philip Wicksteed, the English economist of the early 20th century, late 19th, who was the first to sort of discuss it in any detail. It's something sort of intermediate between the PSR and the FSR. There's also what Mises called the evenly rotating economy, which is a kind of general equilibrium construct that Mises uses to explain the difference between profit and interest. note that you know, the FSR and the ERE and to some extent the WSR are more like imaginary constructs, meaning they may not actually ever take place. In fact, the FSR and the ERE never can occur in the real world, or they never do occur in the real world. The ERE could not even conceivably occur in the real world because it has some self-contradictory assumptions built into it. Yet it is still a useful thinking tool, a useful heuristic, if you like, what Mises called an imaginary construct that helps us to understand certain things conceptually. You know, the FSR, I mean, you could conceive of that coming about if you could sort of, if you had magic powers and you could freeze everybody's preferences and you could, you know, make free, you know, to keep certain characteristics of natural resources constant. If you had godlike powers, you could make an FSR obtain, but that wouldn't actually happen in the absence of some kind of godlike powers. The point I'm trying to make here is that there are lots of different equilibrium constructs that are used in the Austrian tradition. And people get confused because some of them, like the PSR, are 100% realistic, and they occur every day. Others, like the FSR and the ERE, are not realistic, but yet still useful as tools of thinking. So, sort of blanket statements that, well, we should reject equilibrium because equilibrium never exists in the real world. Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by equilibrium. If we call the PSR an equilibrium, then that kind of equilibrium does obtain in the real world. Okay? We'll be talking more about these equilibrium constructs in the next few weeks as we talk about different market situations and so forth. A little bit about demand before we stop to have some questions. We already talked last week about the critically important idea of diminishing marginal utility. But because additional units of a good are worth less to the consumer, to induce a consumer to buy additional units, right, beyond the amount the consumer would buy in a particular plain state of rest, the seller has to offer a lower price, right? So in my previous slide, at a price of $1.25, my quantity demanded was 3. If the seller wants me to buy a fourth, the seller is going to have to lower the price, you know, low enough so that the fourth water bottle is now higher for me than $1.25. Such that the fourth water bottle for me is now higher than whatever that new price, that new lower price is. Exactly what the price is, well, I mean, economic theory doesn't tell us. Praxeology doesn't tell us how low the price has to be to induce me to buy the fourth. And that's the question of entrepreneurial judgment and trial and error and so forth. But that's why an individual's demand schedule, or the demand curve, meaning a graphical representation of that schedule, i.e. the quantity that the individual will purchase, the quantity demanded as a function of price, you know, is downward sloping. An individual's demand curve is downward sloping because of the law of diminishing marginal utility. Okay. If we want to look at demand curves in a market, right, we simply sum up the quantities demanded of individuals who make up the market, right? So, you know, if there are two people in the market, Peter and Paul, we have the quantity that Peter would demand at every, you know, at a series of prices, the quantity that Paul would demand as a series of among these prices, and we simply do a horizontal summation, and that tells us the total amount that the market would demand at those prices. So, by the way, these demand curves, quantity as a function of price, there are some things that we know about them, right? We know that they cannot be upward sloping, because that would violate the law of diminishing marginal utility. But by no means do they have to be straight lines. I mean, a lot of, you know, typical mainstream textbook draws the demand curve as a downward sloping line, or a lot of them used to draw demand curves as rectangular hyperbolas, you know, these nice little smooth concave shapes. You know, some of that is just ease of exposition, right? But of course, we recognize that praxeologically, there's first of all, not only is there no reason to expect the demand curve to approximate these shapes, I mean, taken literally, it would be impossible for the demand curve to be a continuous line in the mathematical sense of, you know, continuous of a straight line, right? Because quantities cannot be divided into infinitesimally small amounts, right? You know, if you do a mathematical representation of demand, there's a lot of assumptions built into expressing a demand curve as a formula, namely, you know, continuity and differentiability and infinitesimally small units and so forth. But human action never refers to infinitesimally small units of goods and services. Right, as we saw last week, human action only refers to specific, discrete, marginal units. Now, how big or small can those marginal units be? Well, I mean, that depends on the circumstances. It depends on the individual transactor. Right? I mean, I guess you can imagine somebody, I mean, look, think of, you know, salt. Think of, yeah, and not table salt, but, you know, sea salt, or the kind of coarse, the more coarse grains of salt, the little chunks of salt that you can buy in a gourmet food shop. You know, typically, you don't buy one salt crystal. You know, you buy a set of salt crystals. So, you know, for salt, the smallest feasible trading unit is some kind of a small container, right? But if we're talking about diamonds, right, I mean, you can imagine raw diamonds or even cut diamonds that are smaller than a little chunk of salt. Now then, yes, you do, you know, we have sort of measurement instruments and very fine tools that allow us to exchange individual units, little pieces of the diamond. So, you know, there's no praxeological definition of the smallest unit that is relevant for human action for a particular commodity or service. It depends on the characteristics of those individuals and the good or service in question. But we know it's finite, right? So there's this thing that's, you know, in the limit as quantities approach, you know, minus infinity in size. That doesn't make any sense from the point of view of human action. But a realistic demand curve is going to be, you know, jagged and will typically have gaps, right? Just another example that I have on hand. You know, here's the demand curve in the market for milk, you know, price and quantity. If we plot those particular prices and quantities, you know, you get a demand curve that, first of all, notice it's not even a curve, right? There's no line. There's just a bunch of X's. Now, we could draw a line, of course. Let's see, can I do that without messing it up? Ooh, I didn't mean the line to be that big, but to be that fat. You know, we could draw a straight line, but, you know, it's not going to be a perfect, even if I had greater skill, it wouldn't be a perfectly smooth line. The reading from the Shapiro text has examples of some different demand curves that are, you know, nicely plotted, showing that they aren't continuous and smooth, and you can't take the derivative of them. So, I mean, that isn't to say that. I'll make this thing smaller. Okay, that isn't to say that there might not be a case where I want to, you know, if I'm drawing a diagram for you guys, you know, to illustrate something in particular, you know, I might just as a convenient shorthand, you know, draw a demand curve that looks like that. So imagine a downward sloping demand curve. Just because, you know, if I draw it like this, know, that if that doesn't make a difference in terms of the phenomenon I want to explain, then I'm just going to use the straight line because it's easier to draw and it's less confusing. But we certainly don't want to reach conclusions that are contingent upon drawing the demand curve as a straight line. Okay, then we've got a problem. I'll very briefly mention the concept of elasticity. I don't need to say a lot about it because it's treated very well in the text that you have, in the Shapiro text. And, you know, most of the mainstream texts treat elasticity in a pretty innocuous manner, too. You know, one of the reasons that we're interested in it is because, you know, sort of what might happen in a market where we have supply and demand curves. You know, and I realize we haven't talked about the details of the supply curve yet. What we think the shape of the demand curve looks like has an impact on what we think will happen in a particular market. You know, so for example, imagine two goods, gasoline and candy, and imagine that the demand curve for candy is pretty steep, right, which suggests that the amount that people are willing to buy really isn't very sensitive to the price. You know, if you got to get to work, you got to have gas. You grumble when the price of gas goes up, but you don't cut back your consumption a whole lot, at least not in the short term. The long term, you might do so by riding the bus or carpooling and so forth. But in the short term, the quantity of gasoline you're willing to buy doesn't vary a whole lot with the price. Whereas for something like candy, the quantity demanded might vary a lot more with price. So, you know, we might depict the gasoline market by drawing a fairly steep demand curve for gasoline, or we might depict the candy market with a fairly flat demand curve for candy. Who cares? Well, I mean, imagine that there's some change in supply conditions. Imagine there's a leftward shift of the supply curve of equal magnitude. Right? This is one of those kind of optical illusion thingies. You know, here I've got the exact same supply shifts, you know, supply curve shifting to the left, exact same shifts depicted on the graph because I just copied and pasted in PowerPoint. But you see that the impact on price is substantially different. But in both cases, a leftward shift of the supply curve results in a smaller equilibrium quantity and a higher equilibrium price. But in the case of gasoline, you know, it's sort of a big increase in price. And in the case of candy, it's a very small increase in price. So the point is, we might be interested in being able to characterize this aspect of the demand curve in a more sophisticated way than saying, you know, well, I can draw it like it's steep, or I can draw it like it's pretty flat. And, you know, that's what the concept of elasticity helps us to do. Right? The way I usually explain this to my own students is, a good synonym for elasticity would be responsiveness. So more generally, elasticity refers to the responsiveness of, you know, one variable to another, or more precisely, the responsiveness, you know, of a change in one variable to a change in another. So, for example, what we call the price elasticity of demand tells us how responsive is quantity to a change in price. And, you know, there's a pretty standard way of doing this. Formula for elasticity, I'm representing it here with the Greek letter eta, which is the way one of the textbooks that I used does it, says that it's given by the percent change in quantity demanded divided by the percent change in price. The percent change in quantity demanded over the percent change in price. There are different ways that you can calculate percentage changes. Here I'm going to use so-called midpoint formula, right, and define the percentage change in the following way. So the percent change in quantity demanded is the absolute change in quantity demanded, you know, from 10 units to 12 units, divided by the average of 10 and 12. Okay, if you just think about it kind of algebraically, or just mathematically, right, what we get as a percent change depends on what we use as the starting point. And to avoid that, we often use these so-called midpoint formulas. So define the percent change quantity demanded as the absolute change in quantity demanded in numbers divided by the average of the old quantity and the new quantity, and the percent change in price as the change in price divided by the average of the old price and the new price. And that gives you a number, right? And so if we have actual numbers for a demand curve or a demand schedule, like we did in some of our previous examples here, we can calculate a number for elasticity. It's often depicted with a minus sign to remind us that price and quantity demanded move in opposite directions along the downward sloping demand curve. And there's some conventional terminology. If the numerator is bigger than the denominator in absolute value terms, then we say that the demand is elastic. If the numerator is smaller than the denominator in absolute value terms, we say demand is inelastic. Okay. Now, mathematically, you could define so-called unit elasticity as the case where the numerator and the denominator of this formula are exactly equal. Although, as we'll see in just a moment, that isn't a very useful definition. There's an interesting relationship. Excuse me, just one second. Sorry, I had to shut off my video for a second. Am I back? Can you see me? You got video again? Somebody tell me if you can see me.
Yeah, video's back.
Okay, good, thanks. What was I saying? Okay. Actually, let me skip this in the interest of time. You can read about this in any conventional text, the relationship between elasticity and revenue. What determines elasticity? Two important determinants. One is the availability of substitutes, right? So if a good has many close substitutes, subjectively perceived from the point of view of the consumer, right, then at a higher price, the consumer can easily switch to one of the substitutes. Therefore, the quantity demanded will be highly sensitive to the price. If the seller raises the price, consumers will buy substantially less of the good or service because they can easily substitute for something else. If there are few substitutes, then the demand will be less elastic because if at a higher price, to have the need satisfied, the consumer has fewer alternatives to the good or service in question and will purchase even more. Will not reduce their purchases by very much, for example, if the price were to go up. Another determinant of elasticity of demand is how much of your total budget you spend on this particular good or service. So if expenditure on the good or service in question represents a large portion of your total monthly expenditure, for example, then your demand will be relatively more elastic than it would be otherwise. Okay? For convenience of drawing, as I did on my slide with gasoline and candy, right? And Shapiro discusses this in pretty nicely. The flatter the demand curve within a given range of prices, the more elastic the demand, other things equal. Okay, so drawing a steep line is a convenient shorthand for a less elastic demand curve. And drawing a flatter line is a convenient depiction of a more elastic demand. But you want to be very careful, right, to make sure that the way any sort of arbitrary depiction of a demand curve or convenient depiction of a demand curve is not driving, a particular analytical result. In the mainstream literature, they talk about constant or unitary elastic demand curves that have the same elasticity throughout their length, and those would be curved. If you've never done this before, you can easily look this up. A straight line demand curve actually has a different elasticity within every range on the curve. There's something in the literature on perfect competition, the so-called perfectly elastic demand and supply curve and demand curve. You can imagine a perfectly inelastic demand curve, horizontal lines and vertical lines respectively. But those are not consistent with human action because, again, human action always only applies to, you know, discrete units of goods and services, not infinitesimally small ones. Okay, I'm gonna skip my discussion of income elasticity and cross-price elasticity in the interest of time. But, you know, a fun example that I use in my classes, my undergraduate students usually get a kick out of this. You know, I teach at the University of Missouri, and Missouri is a kind of average U.S. state. It isn't particularly distinguished in any category, except one of the things that we're number one in is crystal meth. Apparently, the state of Missouri has more crystal meth production than any other state in the U.S. If you've ever seen the movie Winter's Bone, terrific movie about the crystal meth culture in kind of a very rural part of Missouri. Great film. Imagine that you believe the demand for an addictive substance like crystal meth is highly inelastic, meaning that users do not, the extent to which quantities change when price changes is pretty small. If you have to have your fix, you're going to buy crystal meth even when the price goes up. When the price goes up, you don't reduce your consumption by that much, right? Now, so if you believe that's the case, you might have a diagram that looks something like the one on the left. But suppose you think that, well, most people who take crystal meth are just casual users. They just kind of want to see what it's like. And if the price went up, they would not buy it anymore. Then you might have a much more elastic demand curve from meth. Why does that matter? Well, as most of you guys know, economists tend to be very skeptical about the drug war. Many economists favor legalization of drugs, decriminalizing many drugs or all drugs. By the way, not necessarily because they're libertarians, right? Most libertarians oppose drug laws for normative reasons, right? Because they think it's improper for the government to outlaw a person, putting a substance in his body, right? And again, buying drugs is a voluntary transaction, just like the ones we talked about at the start of today's lecture. And if you think that voluntary exchange is mutually beneficial, forbidding the user from purchasing a unit of an addictive drug from a seller is outlawing a transaction that would have been mutually beneficial, okay? That's a libertarian reason. Actually, that's an economic reason, too, but I guess the point I'm making is most economists, especially mainstream economists, are in favor of legalization not on libertarian grounds and not on just sort of voluntary exchange as mutually beneficial grounds, but on a much more kind of utilitarian, with a much more utilitarian kind of argument that, well, the drug law is harmful to drug laws, the drug war is harmful to society because it causes a lot of crime. Right? Why does it cause crime? Well, look, imagine that we were to decriminalize crystal meth, right? So one obvious impact of, making drugs illegal adds to the production cost, right? So the meth producer has to get the inputs and hire the labor and have facilities and so on, but also has to pay for protection and paying off the police and having guys with guns and engaging in shootouts and so forth. So avoiding detection, avoiding getting caught and punished is a cost of doing business. And so when drugs are illegal, those costs are very high. Right? If we were to decriminalize crystal meth, the effect would be a reduction in the cost of producing crystal meth. And those of you who've studied supply and demand before know that you can depict a decrease in production cost by doing what to the supply curve? Yeah, that's right, shifting the supply curve to the left. So imagine we decriminalize meth, that reduces the cost of producing meth, shifts the supply curve for meth to the left. What impact does that have on the price of meth, right? Well, if the demand for meth is highly inelastic, then a shift in the supply curve has a huge impact on the price. Okay? So, I'm sorry, guys, I said it backwards. It's getting late in the day. I said it backwards. If reducing production costs shift the supply curve to the right, increasing production costs shift the supply curve to the left. So sorry, my pictures here depict starting at a situation where meth is legal and then making it illegal, right? So what I wanted to say is, suppose that we now pass laws on drugs, what impact do they have? Well, by increasing the cost of production, right, we shift the supply curve to the left and we increase the market price, okay? But if the demand for meth is highly elastic, most users are casual users who make their decision about whether or not to use meth based on how expensive it is that day, right? Then, yeah, I mean, the price is going to go up, but not by that much, right? And the quantity will go down by a lot, right? So if you think, oh, but you know, the high prices, that's what brings in the cartels and the mafia, and that's what leads to all this crime and all these problems, you know, then we might not think that making drugs illegal would have much of a harmful effect, right? Yeah, it increases the price, but just a little bit, and it reduces the quantity quite a lot, and that means less use and less people who are harming their bodies and so forth, right? However, if you think that demand is highly inelastic, then making it illegal and increasing the production cost, as on the picture on the left, you know, it reduces use a little bit. But look what it does to the price. It increases the equilibrium price by a huge amount, right? So if you think that the high prices are a problem because that brings in the gangs and that leads to the crime and people stealing to support their habit and so forth, then you'd think that it's really, really harmful in on a purely utilitarian ground, right, to make drugs illegal. So again, this is why most mainstream economists on purely utilitarian grounds think that drug laws are counterproductive. It's because they believe that the demand for most illegal drugs is highly inelastic, right? So by making it illegal, you're just jacking the price way up and having very little impact on use. Or if you want to flip it around, right? If you make my arrows go the other way and flip P1 and P2, right? If you legalized, if you decriminalized crystal meth and shifted the supply curve to the right, if demand is inelastic, the price would plummet. If demand is elastic, then the price wouldn't go down by that much. If you think reducing street prices would be good for reducing crime, then you would strongly support legalization, again, on purely utilitarian grounds, if you think demand is inelastic. And of course, most studies of drug markets show, most, you know, applied studies estimate that the demand really is very inelastic, okay? So even if you only looked at one of the purely consequentialist arguments, if you think the demand for drugs is inelastic, you should support legalization. Okay, this is just an example of why we might be interested in elasticity. In other words, if all we know is that the demand for crystal meth obeys the law of diminishing marginal utility, then all we know is the demand curve is downward sloping. That's useful information, but we might want to know even more than that. How steep is the demand curve? For that, we need some information about elasticity. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm talking way more than I really want to talk, but I'll just stop with this. you know, we're talking here indirectly about the division of labor, right? So when we have voluntary exchange and lots of voluntary exchanges, we have a robust and strong and widespread division of labor. Right? Why do we have exchange? Because there's a variety of different resources in the economy. People have different skills and different preferences. And we get these huge gains in productivity when we take advantage of that variety, when we exploit it through specialization and the division of labor. In fact, Mises in Human Action describes voluntary exchange according to the division of labor as the fundamental law of society. The reason we have society, according to Mises, and not, you know, just isolated individuals, is to take advantage of the division of labor and the gains from trade. So economic relationships among people, exchange relationships among people are, for me, is the fundamental human relationship. It's not power. It's not exploitation. It's not a political kind of thing. The most basic, the reason that we have society, the reason that society is beneficial is because of voluntary exchange and the division of labor. Right? And what Mises calls the law of association, following Ricardo, or what modern scholars typically call the law of comparative advantage, right? Says that people will tend to specialize in those activities where they have the greatest relative advantage in production. Right? So even people who are, you know, even people who have relatively few skills can still benefit from participation in the division of labor, right? They still have a role to play in the division of labor, and they can make better off people who have a lot of skills, right? So the division of labor gains from trade is not one way. It's not that, well, the more able people, you know, help the little people. It's sort of a Randian notion of, you know, the supermen who are dragging the rest of us along with them. No, I mean, the principle of comparative advantage says that even the most able workers benefit from the participation of the least able workers, because the least able free up the more able from doing tasks that the more able, you know, may be good at, but it allows them to do things in which they're even better than other people in society. Okay? That's it for today. I'm sorry, I went way over my lecture time, but I do want to take some time for questions, and we can go a little bit beyond 8 o'clock Eastern tonight if we need to. I didn't get a chance to scroll through the question queue during the lecture, but I'm going to do so now. Give me a second just to read through some of these. Okay, there's a question from Mark. Mark says, it's a good question. Mark says, valuation is subjective, as we discussed last time. But in the readings for this week, I'm paraphrasing Mark, you know, it was also the case that objective facts of scarcity affect valuations as well. Isn't this a contradiction to what we've said about the role of subjective value? And Mark, it's a good question, but I think it's not a contradiction for the following reason, right? You know, the objective fact of scarcity is relevant for exchange only to the extent that it is perceived subjectively by actors, right? So when we talk about the objective qualities of goods or services, it's not that, you know, look, so this water bottle is plastic, and I guess the plastic, you know, is made of petroleum, right? So, yes, it's true that if there weren't petroleum, and there weren't, you know, chemical processes for translating the petroleum into plastic and manufacturing plastic bottles and putting the water in, and so on, you know, there wouldn't be any possibility of me trading for this bottle of water. I mean, that is true, but it isn't the purely physical, objective properties of the resources. Those are not sufficient to give them exchange value. Right, you know, before people had figured out how to extract oil out of the ground and make it into gasoline and kerosene and plastic and so forth, you know, it was just sticky black goo, right, that you didn't want to have on your property, right? So what constitutes a resource depends on people's, you know, on the state of knowledge, on our, you know, our scientific knowledge and our perception of the resource's existence and so forth. Right, so yeah, but you're right to raise this point. We're not in any way saying that, you know, human action is, you know, sort of that it doesn't take place in the real world, that there's no role for objective reality, that, you know, it's not like we're all plugged into the matrix and everything is just going on in our minds, right? No, I mean, you know, there is objective reality out there. It's objective reality that human beings are making sense of. Right, but you still need human, you need the human mind to partition the physical thing off into discrete units, to value those units and so forth. And so certainly there is a role to be played by objective factors, but objective characteristics per se are not enough to help us understand valuation and exchange. Okay, and please chime in with a follow-up question or or ask me privately an email if it doesn't make sense. Malcolm is asking for recommended readings. What are some arguments that are used to try to justify restrictions on trade on the grounds that they somehow make us better off? I have to think about that. I mean, this may shock some of you, but if you're in the case of international trade, you know, tariffs and quotas, restrictions on trade among people living in different countries, a really good book on that is by, I hate to say it, Paul Krugman. You know, before he became an angry polemicist, Paul Krugman was a pretty decent international trade economist, not a great one in my humble judgment, but a solid one. And he wrote some good books on free trade, defending free trade. His book, one is called Pop Internationalism, some back in the 90s. And it's actually a very good book on, you know, sort of common fallacies that people make in favor of restricting trade. You know, for tariffs, for example, so-called infant industry argument that, well, we need to restrict, you know, we need to make it illegal for A to buy from B because B is already well established and there's C over here who's just starting out. We need to coerce A to buy from C rather than B to give C a fair chance to kind of get up and running. But once C gets to, you know, be just as strong as B, then we can remove the restriction and allow A to choose whether he wants to buy from B or C. You know, we have to level the playing field, quote unquote. You know, Krugman has some great arguments against those sort of silly claims that people make. You know, for sort of trade more generally, I have to think about it. Another very good writer on this is Douglas Irwin, I-R-W-I-N, and he has a couple of popular books on the history of free trade and sort of theory of free trade that refute a lot of common fallacies. But again, I think he's mostly focusing on international trade. By the way, one of Mises' real contributions was to emphasize that the principle of comparative advantage, the law of association was first formulated by Ricardo, does not exclusively apply to international trade. In a mainstream economics course, typically the only time, you know, it's like there's a chapter on demand, a chapter on supply, a chapter on pricing and competition and so forth, and then, you know, maybe at the very end of the book, there's a little chapter on international trade, tariffs and quotas and so forth, where they then introduce the principle of comparative advantage. Now, that explains why, you know, it might be valuable for the U.S. to trade with China instead of the U.S. trying to manufacture everything in-house. You know, the Chinese have a comparative advantage in certain kinds of manufacturing, so free trade between the U.S. and China makes both the U.S. and China better off. Mises pointed out that that's perfectly true, but that's not only true of trade among between nations. It's also true of any voluntary exchange. Right, Mises uses the example of a surgeon who hires an assistant to clean the surgical instruments. But even if the surgeon could clean them more quickly than the assistant, it's still in the surgeon's interest to hire the assistant. And that frees up the surgeon to concentrate on surgery and other things where the surgeon is much, much better than the assistant, right? So the surgeon is just a little bit better than the assistant, let's say, in cleaning the scalpels and so on. But, you know, it's way better than the assistant in performing surgery or giving lectures or whatever else the surgeon does. So it's in the surgeon's interest to hire an assistant, even though the surgeon is really even better than the assistant at doing what the assistant does, right? So the law of association is a very general principle that explains why we have specialization and exchange and the division of labor throughout society. It doesn't just apply between countries. Roberto is asking, hi Roberto, how are you doing? Is asking about Ricardo. Yeah, I mean, there are some differences between, you know, Mises' formulation and Ricardo's formulation of this principle, but they're pretty minor. Mises accepted Ricardo's version as being essentially correct. Okay, sorry, Malcolm's asked me a follow-up question. Apparently I did not answer his question correctly because I didn't understand, I misunderstood it. So Malcolm, you're asking for a good overview of arguments against trade restrictions. Yeah, I mean, any of the basic Austrian texts, I think the texts that were, there are later chapters of Shapiro that also talk about trade restrictions. So I think you can find those in probably any of our readings for this course. And, you know, probably a lot of mainstream texts have some good arguments against trade restrictions as well. Somebody's suggesting some stuff by David Friedman on international transactions. So I'm sure that would be a fine place to start. I'm going to look through the chat queue also just to see if there's anything I want to address here in the chat. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, some of the chat discussion revolves around kind of the moral implications of things like trade restrictions. And, you know, I haven't talked about those, not because I think they aren't important, but because they're, you know, that's the realm of political philosophy and moral philosophy and political theory, which is distinct from that of praxeology. So I'm saying, I mean, look, personally, I have a moral objection to restrictions on trade. You know, if I want to exchange, you know, this pen and somebody else has, you know, here's a red pen and somebody else has a blue pen, the blue pen, and I want to trade red pen for blue pen and the government says I can't, I regard that as immoral. But I regard that as a violation of my individual rights. But the point I'm making tonight is, even if you didn't think that, right, even if you had no moral view whatsoever, or you had some kind of moral view in which it's right for the government to make these determinations, but even on pure technical efficiency grounds, right, if I trade a red pen for a blue pen, we know, you know, we have very strong scientific knowledge that there has just been an increase in welfare, right? Both parties have been made better off by the result of this exchange. If the government forbids that exchange, then there's a potential gain in welfare that didn't take place. Right? There's a reduction in well-being. We can make that statement without any particular moral views whatsoever. And of course, most people would also think have a moral objection. But you know, there are other cases, like in the case of drugs, right, where people's moral intuition doesn't always go in the same, doesn't always give the same answer as praxeology. I mean, you know, I'm guessing that a lot of you listening in tonight, you know, probably have, you know, libertarian views on drugs, but you recognize that a lot of well-intentioned people think, you know, no, if somebody wants to use meth, you know, in some objective sense, in some biological sense, you know, in terms of harm they're doing to their body, maybe in a spiritual sense, you know, they're actually hurting themselves, and we want to stop them from hurting themselves. People might think it's moral to forbid somebody from using drugs. You know, whether it is or is not, that's a question for David Gordon or for, you know, a Mises Academy course in moral philosophy. Right? But even if you thought that it's immoral for people to take drugs, it's still the case that the drug user, in an ex ante sense, perceives himself to be worse off if he can't buy the drugs and take them than if he can buy the drugs and take them. Right? So our moral intuition may sometimes give us a different answer from the answer that's given to us by praxeology. Let me look through a couple of other comments here. Let's see. Let's see. I'm skipping the technical questions about microphones and cameras and quiz availability and so on, because I think those are already being answered pretty nicely. Let's see. Yeah, great discussion in the chat, but I don't think I have anything in particular to add to what's already been said. Okay, I think we're 5 minutes over time, and I'm sorry, tonight we had more lecture than I would really like and less Q&A than I would really like, but that's the way it goes sometimes. But it's been great having you guys with us today. So next week, we're going to combine the first 2 weeks, and we're going to get into much more detail about how prices are actually set. Okay, so the examples of exchange that we've given so far have been like the horses and cows example, where we're just doing barter. Or we've said, we've talked about the law of demand. If the price is $1.25, how many water bottles will Peter buy? But we haven't yet said, well, why is the price $1.25? What explains why the price is $1.25 and not $1.50 or $1 or whatever? So now by thinking more systematically about value scales and interactions among potential buyers and sellers, we can not only determine an equilibrium quantity, as we did with the horses and cows example, but also an equilibrium price, okay? That's what we're going to do, or one of the things that we'll do in next week's session, which will be Thursday, July the 19th. And let me remind you as an administrative note that after next week's class, we then take a week off. So we don't have class on July the 26th. That's right in the middle of Mises University, and I'll be teaching, and some of you will be at Mises U, and that's a good time for us to take a little break. But we'll have a one-week break, and then we continue with 3 more weeks after that. So, again, thanks for being here. Good night, everybody. And I will please keep in touch by email and phone and the discussion boards on Moodle in the interim. We'll have quiz number 2 available for you hopefully over the weekend or by Monday at the latest. So thanks a lot, everybody. I will see you later.